Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 303. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, stroll on over to the Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have a jam-packed show for you this week. We must get started with our first guest. Luke Yankee is a writer, a director, a producer, an actor, a storyteller, a teacher, a lecturer, and just one of my favorite radio guests ever. His critically acclaimed memoir, Just Outside the Spotlight, has been called, quote, one of the most compassionate, illuminating showbiz books ever written. And that was from The Village Voice. You know it's real. His latest play, The Last Lifeboat, is published by Dramatists Play Service and received its world premiere in Southern California, enjoying a sold-out run. His work, The Jesus Hickey, was the winner of the True Voices Award, as well as the Joel and Phyllis Ehrlich Award, given for a, quote, socially relevant, commercially viable new work of theater. His first play, A Place at Forest Lawn, was the winner of the New Noises Festival Playwriting Award and the Palm Springs International Playwriting Competition. His off-Broadway and regional theater directing credits are way, way too extensive for me to list right now. His stage acting credits, and here's a few fun ones, include Our Town at the American Shakespeare Theater with Kate Mulgrew and the U.S. premiere of The Greeks at the Williamstown Theater Festival, which I love. And he did that one with Gwyneth Paltrow and Christopher Reeve. He has toured the country with Diva Dish, a one-man show he created about the golden age of Broadway and Hollywood. Legendary critic Rex Reed praised Diva Dish as, quote, touching, hilarious, and completely enthralling. I, Ken Schneck, would also like to say that he is touching, hilarious, and completely enthralling, which you will soon hear as we welcome him. Luke Yankee, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Wow, thank you. What an intro. My God, it sounds like I must be 104 to have done all that.
No, and he's only 24, folks. It's really quite impressive. Really,
yes, it's
quite.
All done with mirrors.
Luke, it has been 2 years since you've last been with us.
Amazing. Amazing. Time flies. Now, I have to ask you, is that like a code, or is this really your 303rd show?
It really and truly is our 303rd episode. We celebrated episode 300 a few weeks back with Jim J. Bullock, and it was a blast. Yeah. Crazy,
well,
right?
Congratulations to you.
Well, thank you so much. And we're just celebrating together. We're going to say the 300s are just going to be all of us celebrating.
I'll bring the confetti.
I love it. I love it. And I heard from your brother after you were on the show the first time.
Oh, my God. I'd forgotten that. That was a while ago. That's right. He was kind of blown away with the interview. Yeah.
Well, we had so much fun. And we're going to go back over some of that. We're going to go back over some of that because we have a lot of ground to cover. And as I told you right before we went on the air, it's your second time. So I get to grill you a little bit harder this time.
Great. I'm ready. Bring it on, Daddy.
Well, let's go back a little bit before we talk about Just Outside the Spotlight, because we have to hit some pieces of that. To be clear, Diva Dish, that one-man show, that came first.
Yes, that did come first. Yes, you. I'm amazed at your memory and that you did do your homework. Yeah, I don't know that you mentioned this in the intro. I don't think you did. My mother was the actress Eileen Heckert, who won an Academy Award for the film Butterflies Are Free and is in the Theater Hall of Fame and won, you know, Tonys and Emmys and Oscars and all that stuff. And she had so many amazing stories about having worked with pretty much everybody from the golden age of Hollywood. And as a kid, I would just sit at her feet and worship at her feet as she would, you know, tell all of these amazing stories. And I'd be hearing people like Teresa Wright and Mary Tyler Moore and, just so many, the Newmans, who were great family friends. You know, tell all these amazing show business stories. And I knew my mother would never write a book or do anything with them. So I knew that if I didn't, they would be lost forever. So after she passed away, I created my first one-man show, Diva Dish, and have basically toured really all over the world with it, because I've done it on about 25 cruises everywhere, and I've also done it in regional theaters and pretty much anywhere they'll have me.
Yeah.
And basically, and that then spurred on the book, Just Outside the Spotlight, which has done very, very well, and as you mentioned, has been critically acclaimed and all that good stuff. And then recently, some of the theaters where I had performed over the years said, well, gee, we'd love to have you back if you've got something else. So just this past, over Easter weekend, out in Palm Springs, I launched Diva Dish the Second Helping.
Wow.
So I've launched a whole new one-man show, and it was tremendously successful out in Palm Springs, and I'm going to be doing it in North Hollywood in August.
I love it. I love it. Well, transitioning from Diva Dish to the book, what was that transition like for you to really sit down and say, okay, I'm going to capture these in a different way than me standing up on stage and performing them?
Well, it was very different, Ken, because for one thing, I had to do a lot of research.
Yeah.
Because the book goes into much more detail, and I had to fill in a lot of gaps especially from my mom's early career. I mean, the stuff long before I was born. So, gosh, we're talking about, you know, back when she was doing summer stock in Milwaukee with Teague DaCosta, Morton DaCosta, who went on to direct The Music Man and Auntie Mame and so many amazing things. But that would have been, gosh, that would have been in the 40s.
Yeah.
And so I was culling through scrapbooks and you know, talking to old relatives and all that sort of thing to just piece together the stuff that I didn't know about. And it was a lot of work. And then, you know, just obviously being more involved in the book, and it was a very cathartic and emotional experience. And I think part of the reason I did all this in the first place was it was really part of my grief work after my mom passed away, because we were very, very close. And it was a tough thing to deal with, as it is for anyone when they lose a parent. So ultimately, it became not only a way to share these stories with the world, but a way to keep her alive and to keep her around in a spiritual sense.
Yeah. Well, let's call a spade a spade, or in this case, maybe a rainbow a rainbow. Luke Yankee, do you have a sense that you just had perhaps the gayest childhood ever? When you read these stories, I mean, I would imagine that you listen to people at parties and think, my stories are so much better and so much gayer.
Well, actually, there are a couple other people, one in particular who shall remain nameless, who's the son of a celebrity, who's got another one-man show out there. And I saw it, and I was like, it's okay, but I like mine better. I'll just leave it at that.
Is there one story that you think is just so much gayer than the other? Because, you know, I can pick one for you. I don't know if there's a scale that we can rate them, but does one stick out to you?
I have a feeling the one that you would probably pick, and certainly if you're looking for the gayest one that I would pick, it would be Ethel Merman teaching me how to make a martini when I was 10 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a true Auntie Mae moment in my life.
Yeah.
And I had just seen Hello, Dolly on Broadway starring Miss Merman, and my mother's agent invited her to my parents' big Christmas party. And she was really very great with kids, and she was terribly sweet with me, and she knew what a huge fan I was. And so I went up and introduced myself, and I was trying to be very respectful, and, you know, my mother made it very clear, now you mustn't gush, big stars don't like that.
Right.
So I was saying, you know, how do you do, Miss Merman? I really enjoyed your performance in Hello, Dolly, and my mother would like to know if I could fix you a drink. And in that booming voice you could hear in the second balcony, she said, sure, kid, I'll have a martini. Said, oh, well, Miss Merman, I'm only 10 years old. I'm afraid I don't know how to make a martini. Come on, kid, I'll show you. And showed me exactly how to make her variety of martini. And so for the rest of the evening, whenever anyone would say, hey, Merm, can I freshen your drink? She'd say, no, thank you. Luke's taking care of me.
I mean, Luke, you have to have the sense that other people would tell a story like that as a metaphor, but for you, it's a real thing.
Well, it's so funny. When I was launching the new one-man show, I did a sort of a test, and I got together a couple of people in the clubhouse at my condo complex and, you know, gave them brunch and gave them mimosas to kind of loosen them up and just wanted to get some feedback afterwards. And I was telling some story about my mom. And I said, you know, I didn't, this was after the show when I was getting their notes. I said, you know, I never even knew that until after she died when I read it in the New York Times. And one of my friends said, okay, stop right there. Do you know how few people in the world could even say that sentence
right. That
you just like tossed off without even thinking twice about? And it's true. I mean, when you grow up in that world, you don't think twice about
right.
it.
Right.
I really, you know, I mean, I think I was somewhere around 8 or 9 years old before I realized that not all the other kids sat around watching their mom on TV on Saturday night.
Yeah.
It's just what you did in our household, you know? It was no big deal. It's like, oh, okay, mom's on Gunsmoke tonight. Cool.
Because they were real people as well, and they were real people to whom you had to come out. And so you wrote this in the book. You wrote, just after I turned 18, I came out to my parents. I was too afraid to look them in the eye as I told them. So one spring night, I sat them down in the living room and read them a letter I had written. It was very difficult for them. For all their worldliness, homosexuality was something they just didn't understand. My father was quietly hurt. Mama was extremely vocal about her anger and disappointment. It was one thing for most of Mama's closest friends to be gay, but it was quite another for her fair-haired golden boy. I mean, that had to have been such an experience, because I would imagine you were around gay people growing up in a way that other people weren't at the time.
Absolutely. But, you know, Ken, for that generation, and I'm talking my parents' generation, there really were very few, if any, positive gay role models.
Right.
I mean, what, you know, they associated gay people as being, I'm not saying this was true, but they associated them with being unhappy or alcoholic or, you know, and even the people my mother knew in the theater, they were so desperate, given the times, to try and fit in, that a lot of them were, like, you know, getting married and having families and were terribly unhappy. Or they were just so eager to have a child, again, in an attempt to fit in. And I think part of the reason it was so difficult for them is, A, because of not having the positive role models, but also for that generation, they felt it would be such a harder life for me.
Yeah.
And they wanted me to make another choice because, you know, in that day and age, they believed I had a choice and that it was my choice. It was so interesting. I recently reconnected with a friend from my childhood, somebody I hadn't seen in, wow, like 37 years. And you know, we were saying that basically everybody kind of our age, you know, has that story of coming out to their parents.
Yeah.
And it was not an easy thing to do for any of us, really.
Did you have the sense that that was what their reaction was going to be, or was there an assumption on your part that because your parents were in show business, because they had gay people around them, that their reaction might be different?
I definitely thought it would be different.
Yeah.
I definitely thought it would be different. And my parents and I had a wonderful relationship,
right.
But it was the only time in our lives there was a riff for a while there. You know, it was very, very tough. And the fact that I chose to do it as young as I did, you know, when I was still living at home, I mean, that was really difficult. And so for about 6 months there, before I started at Juilliard, it was very tough, and it was a very challenging time. And, you know, so flash forward about, oh, gosh, about 20 or so years from there, maybe even more than that, when my mom finds out that she's terminal and hasn't told anybody yet. I talk about this in great detail in the book. And so I called to find out how she was feeling, because she was having all these tests and she sort of hemmed and hawed and, you know, changed the subject. And then she suddenly said, now listen, I have to ask you something, but I'm afraid. And I thought, well, that's not something I hear every day from this lady who's so outspoken.
Right.
And she was referring to my current partner, Don, now my husband. And she said, do you think Don would want to call me mom?
Hmm.
And I said, oh, wow, I'm sure he'd be very touched, but you can ask him yourself when we're home at Christmas. She said, no, I'd be too afraid of the rejection if he said no. So you ask him and you let me know what he says.
Wow.
Now, from this lady who said a lot of very painful things when I first came out, out of her fear and out of her, for lack of a better word, ignorance, for this same person to suddenly be asking if she can call my husband will call her mom, it was pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't help but thinking, boy, we've come a long way, baby.
Yeah, the same rejection that so many of us fear when we come out.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the interesting things about Just Outside the Spotlight is the degree to which you are tying your identity to your mother. If you look at the cover, and I'm looking at the cover right here, you have to scan to find the words Luke Yankee on the front cover. What is it like for you? Because you're in the entertainment field, you obviously have your own life. But you have, in this text, tied yourself to your mother and her career. How do you establish your own identity as separate or connected? How do you reconcile that?
That's a really good question, Ken, and it took me a long time to reconcile that. The book was part of doing that. I mean, you know, let's not kid ourselves. I will always be Eileen Heckert's son, and I'm very proud of that.
Yeah.
And I'm also very proud of being Jack Yankee's son.
Yes.
But for many years, especially when I was starting out, I really felt like being the son of legitimized me and gave me a right, if you will, to be in show business. And so, as I said, it took me a long time to sort of come to grips with all of that and to move on from that and to really establish myself on my own. And it's really interesting because a number of people, when they read the book, they say to me, yes, it's your mother's story, and yes, there's a lot about her and your relationship, but let's not kid ourselves. It's really your story.
Yeah.
And it's her career through your filter and through your eyes, and also it's the story of this very complex, very difficult mother-son relationship, which a lot of people can relate to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, listen, you have had, this is a little bit of a dicey question. I'm a little bit nervous about this one. I'm saying that in advance. You have had students in class before. You have in your career given out grades, correct?
Yes.
Okay. If you were to issue a grade to your mother for her Oscar acceptance speech in 1973, now this is dicey. This is our moment of honesty. What grade would you give her?
Well, it really depends on the criteria, because a lot of people, when they see it, they'll be like, my God, that was so short. I mean, it was literally like two or three sentences. Because she was famous for say it and get off. You know, she hated it when people would make speeches and go on and on and on. And so she was incredibly brief in her speech.
Let me pause right there. Let me pause right there because I don't want people to think that you are exaggerating. I timed it. Do you know how many seconds this acceptance speech was?
No.
9 seconds. And I have to say, one of my favorite acceptance...
No, 9 seconds? No, no, no.
Oh, Luke Yankee, 9 seconds long. And I will say, one of my favorite acceptance speeches ever was Merritt Weaver won an award a few years ago for Nurse Jackie, and she just got up there. I love her. And got up there and said, thank you. Thank you so much. I got to go. Your mother's was shorter than that, 9 seconds long.
I don't know. I think your stopwatch might be a little off, but, you know, you're in the driver's seat today, so I'll take it. But one of the things I wish she had done, quite honestly, is that I wish she had thanked my father.
Yeah.
Because they were married for 53 years, and she could not have done anything without him. He was an amazing man, and he just thought, you know, she hung the moon, and he was absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah. By the way, you are going to – I want to put a wager on this because you're going to owe me something. It's 9 seconds. I timed it. Just say it.
All right. I can tell you exactly what she said. She said, I would like to thank the first man who ever recommended me for this part, Howard Otway, and a darling crew, and of course you. Thank you.
That was it.
That was 9 seconds.
Yes.
Well, maybe you did win.
Didn't your father maul her before she got up on stage? Do I remember that story?
Did. Yes. Yes, he did, because he was so excited when she won that he grabbed her and he kissed her so hard that as she got up and went to the stage, he saw a little bit of skin under his thumbnail. And if you look closely at some of the publicity shots of her with Cloris Leachman, you'll see this gash on her chin going all the way down her neck where my father gouged her as he gave her her congratulatory kiss.
So don't you think that's why she didn't thank him? She wasn't happy with him in that moment. This can't possibly be the first time you've thought of this.
I don't think she had any idea.
Okay.
Because afterwards in the publicity shots, Cloris Leachman said to her, are you bleeding? There's something on your chin. She's like, no, I'm fine. I mean, she didn't even feel it. She was so on cloud nine at that moment.
Is it possible that your father did not get so aggressive with her, but perhaps Shelley Winters with a death stare drew some blood?
No, I don't think so.
All right, watch the clip, everyone. I think I have a theory there that's going to last. I'm just saying. Let me just, before we move on to another topic, I have to just ask this generally. I mean, do they make them like your mother anymore?
Oh, gosh. I don't know how to answer that.
Yeah.
Probably, but nobody immediately comes to mind, frankly.
Yeah.
Can you think of anybody?
I can't. And, you know,
sort
Luke...
in that vein of Mom and Elaine Stritch and, you know, Lauren Bacall and those broads?
No, I really can't. And then there is that piece, and I'm sure that you experience this. I have no doubt. I would wager everything on this, and I've won quite a bit because I won a bet earlier about the 9 seconds. I would wager that people have come up to you after you've done Diva Dish and said, "Ah, oh, those were the days," right? That
yeah,
was the golden
much.
Time.
Mm-hmm, very much so.
How would you articulate to people for whom either the golden age is fading from memory or, you know, our younger listeners who just don't know that time, how would you encapsulate the differences?
God, that's a very complicated question, but I don't know. I mean, this may sound like the opposite of everything I've been saying thus far, but, I'm not somebody who really lives in the past.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, yes, of course, I've written a book honoring my mother and the golden age of Broadway and all of that. But, I appreciate, quote unquote, the good old days, but I'm not someone who sits around kind of, you know, living in that realm. I mean, I like to keep moving.
Right.
And thus all the different projects I'm doing. But, there was something special about that era, but, you know, there's something special about this era, too. I mean, you know, we've got Meryl Streep and, some incredible people. Merritt Weaver, who you mentioned,
yeah.
Is so talented. There are a lot of incredible people here, too. James Franco. I mean, I could go on and on.
So it's good. There's good things about today. We don't have to live in the
Absolutely.
Past. Okay.
No way.
What
no
should
way.
Everyone watch? What should our listeners watch if they want the quintessential experience of watching your mother on the screen?
Well, one of the big gay cult films is The Bad Seed, of
yes.
course. And then she was certainly best known for her stuff in The Mary Tyler Moore Show. For younger viewers, they'll know her from The First Wives Club, playing Diane Keaton's mother. And, of course, Butterflies Are Free, for which she won the Oscar.
There you go. There you go. All right. We got to move on to some other project because you've done all these other things. Hey, guess what I read this weekend?
What?
I read The Last Lifeboat.
Oh, wow. I'm flattered and honored.
I enjoyed it immensely. Tell everyone how you came to write The Last Lifeboat.
Well, I did, this ties in, this is a wonderful segue, because one of the cruises I did with Diva Dish several years ago was up in Nova Scotia, and it was an autumn foliage cruise. And the tour guide said at one point, I didn't realize that Nova Scotia was the closest landmass to where the Titanic went down. And so we did this all-day Titanic tour. They had a big Titanic museum up there. And at one point, the tour guide said that J. Bruce Ismay, who was the chairman of the White Star Line, was forced out of the company after the sinking of the Titanic, and he was so destroyed by it that he became a Howard Hughes kind of recluse.
Yeah.
And my ears perked up, and I thought, well, now that's a story about the Titanic I've never heard, with everything that is out there about it, and all the books and movies and everything. So I started doing some research, and I found out just what an amazing story this is about this upper-crust Englishman who always wanted to do the right thing. He went to the right schools, married the right society wife, even though he was in love with someone else, and would do anything he could to try and please his cold Victorian father. And on his father's deathbed, he vowed to him that he would make him proud by building the biggest, grandest ship the world had ever seen. And so J. Bruce Ismay saved a lot of people's lives that night, and then he got into the last lifeboat and saved himself, and as a result, he was made the scapegoat for the sinking of the Titanic for the rest of his life. And no matter how much money he gave to survivors' organizations and to set up pensions for the widows, he could never wash the blood off his hands. And it did kind of affect his mental state over the years. It did kind of drive him crazy.
Yeah.
And just an absolutely fascinating story. There's also never really been anything written about the trials or rather, depicted on screen or on stage about the hearings following the sinking of the Titanic, because there were hearings both in the United States and in the United Kingdom where everyone was trying to point a finger at everyone else. And of course, a disaster of that magnitude is everyone's fault and no one's fault. So there was no one to really pin the blame on. So first, they certainly tried to pin it on Ismay, but so first I wrote this as a big epic screenplay, sort of in the vein of the King's Speech, and then I thought, okay, just as an experiment, let's see if I could write this as a play, sort of in the vein of the Laramie Project or Peter and the Starcatcher, where I tell a big epic story with an ensemble cast on a bare stage. and sent it off to Dramatist Play Service before it had even been produced anywhere. And they said, we see tremendous potential in this, and we would like to publish it.
Nice.
So I had it published before it had even had its first production, which is a lovely position to be in. And then it was done this fall, this past fall, down at UC Irvine, and tremendously successful. And so other little productions are starting to spring up around the country. It's currently on the desk of a couple of Broadway producers, and I am holding the happy thought.
I love it. At one point during the play, one of the characters says this about Ismay: what we do know is that for this one decision, the world never forgave him. And I read that line and I thought, well, that's just really is that could be a treatise on anything about modern celebrity, about any type of public mistake.
Well, exactly. But talk about, you know, a mistake that is like one of those defining moments of your life.
Right.
Where he just, you know, there were no other passengers around. And he thought, well, I'm on this ship, even though he was the chairman of the line, he was on the ship as a passenger. So he felt he was entitled to get into the last lifeboat. And also he felt that someone in a position of authority, because certainly the captain was going to go down with the ship, would need to tell what happened, what really happened. So with the best of intentions and trying to do the right thing, he got into the last lifeboat, and it destroyed the rest of his life.
Yeah. Ismay says at one point during the play, the Titanic is like a lifeboat in itself, practically unsinkable. What's a lifeboat to Luke Yankee? What are your lifeboats?
Wow. What are my lifeboats? My husband,
yes,
of 20 years is absolutely my lifeboat and my anchor and any other wonderful metaphor you want to come up with.
He's so nautical. He's such a nautical metaphor. I love it.
He also directed the production at in Irvine this fall.
Okay, wait a second. Wait a second. I heard you say he did a brilliant job, but what was that like for you? Because I would imagine you, who has directed many a stage production, you have handed it over to this nautical metaphor that you love so much. Were there moments that you thought to yourself, I might do that a little bit differently?
They were very few.
Okay.
And also, I was the dialect coach on the production as well, because that's one of the other hats that I wear. And so Don was incredibly generous with me. And there were times that he would be looking at the big picture, and I would be looking at the minutiae, and I would kind of go over and whisper in his ear, don't forget, blah, 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 and blah. And he, you know, in almost every case, he took the notes and took them respectfully. And it was for both of us, it was one of the most satisfying artistic experiences we've ever had.
Wow.
It's yeah, we were a little nervous, a little apprehensive going into it, but thought, oh, how's this going to work? But it worked beautifully, and the show was a tremendous success, and we were both absolutely thrilled with the outcome.
And for folks who would like to stage this, from what I understand, you can do it with 5 actors, or you could have like 300 actors. There are that many parts in there.
Well, it can be done with as few as 7.
7.
But ideally, somewhere around a dozen is kind of perfect. Basically, you know, on a bare stage.
There you go.
And with minimal sets and costumes and, you know, just a few chairs and tables and that sort of thing. And yeah, it's a fascinating story about the Titanic that nobody knows.
Now, the character does have a conflicted relationship with his father. Anything that we want to talk about there in your own life? And folks need to go back 2 years ago, because we love talking about your father, because it would be so easy to just talk about your mother, but your father, such a huge influence on your life. And I will say, going back to the coming out story, one of the things I love about your coming out story, it was like shortly thereafter that, and again, this is not a metaphor, folks, that you were on stage with your father doing Tea and Sympathy.
My, you have done your homework. I actually tell that story in the new one-man show. Because you know, my father, I had come out to my folks, and here I am cast in a community theater production of Tea and Sympathy, playing this young boy who's falsely accused of being gay because he's into art and music and poetry. And so, and they couldn't find anyone else to play the role of the boy's father. So my dad had done a few things in community theater. And so I suggested him for the role. And so here we are playing these scenes where I'm saying things to him like, wait a minute, Dad, you don't think I'm queer, do you? And you know, we were living this at home, and yet we were not able to talk about it because it was just too close to the bone. it was just, it was too kind of in our faces at the moment.
But that's not Ismay's connection with his father. So I feel yours was a little bit healthier.
Oh, mine was a lot healthier.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Now, something else that I heard about you, this is fun. This is getting fun.
Uh-oh.
I heard that the LA Actors Fund Tony Awards Gala is like the party to be at, and you play no small part in that.
Actually, and that brings me up to a fabulous story, as a matter of fact. But yes, the biggest fundraiser for the Actors Fund, which, for those of you who don't know, is a charity, a huge charity in the entertainment industry, and it's not just for actors. I mean, it's for designers, it's for grips, it's for stage managers, it's for anyone in the entertainment industry, musicians, etc. And their biggest fundraiser is a Tony Awards viewing party, where they have a live feed of the Tonys from New York. So it's kind of the snob factor. So people in LA can be seeing the Tonys in real time.
Right.
And there's a lovely dinner and a silent auction. And they always give a Lifetime Achievement Award, or several, to a prominent person in the entertainment industry. And for the past 4 years now, I have directed it. But last year and this year, I'm writing, directing, and producing it. So it's kind of huge. And this year we are honoring, the theme is Broadway's Leading Men, and we are honoring Tim Curry, Alfred Molina, Joe Morton, and Theodore Bekel.
Wow.
And we're lining up some amazing talent and entertainment for the event as well. It's going to be hosted by the fabulous Kate Burton, who's a longtime friend, speaking of another child of. And I'm really, really excited about the event. It's shaping up beautifully.
Wow. You want everyone to walk away having a pretty darn good time.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And speaking of which, last year's event was, this segues into the story I wanted to share. Last year's event was an honor. They were honoring Barbara Cook, and who was just extraordinary. And Florence Henderson was the host, and she was amazing, and we've become very dear friends. So a lot of the old Hollywood divas show up for this event. And frankly, I would love to have the false eyelash concession for this event, because there's Ruta Lee, and there's Ann Jeffries, and there's Charlotte Ray, and there's, you know, all the old Hollywood dames. So after the event, Lee Merriweather comes up to me. And Lee Merriweather is a dear friend. And of course, having been a former Miss America and all the TV stuff and everything, she's just still absolutely stunning. And just a really handsome older woman, you know, just really classy and elegant. And she looks at me and she says, "Oh, darling, it was a marvelous party. It was just..." And then she studies me for a moment and she says, "You've done something. What have you done?" And I knew what she was inferring, and so I said, "Well, Lee, I haven't done anything, but I went vegetarian about a year and a half ago, and I've lost about 15 pounds. So she shouts to her husband across the crowded ballroom in front of all these celebs. She shouts, "Marshall, darling, he didn't have work done. He just went vegetarian." Because I'm sure all evening they were saying, "No, Luke looks too good. Luke's had something done. He's had a nip and a tuck."
How is the vegetarian lifestyle? As you know, a huge proponent of that, having been a vegetarian for a good chunk of my life, everything going okay for you?
It's pretty fabulous.
Yeah.
Yes. I do eat fish, so I guess the technical term is I'm a pescatarian.
You are one of those. That's fine.
Yes, indeed. But no, I really love it, and boy, I don't miss the meat at all.
Wow. By the way, I'm trying to move on to other topics, but I just keep thinking about Charlotte Ray now. That can't be normal.
Oh, she's a dear lady. I'm crazy about Charlotte. She's just so loving and warm and down to earth. She's just a terrific lady. I've directed her in a couple of readings and benefits and other things as well, and she's a love.
Wow. Is there someone you're dying to meet?
Gosh. Well, I mentioned her earlier, Meryl Streep.
Okay.
There are a couple of actors who I'd love to play Ismay in the film of The Last Lifeboat. People like Colin Firth,
nice.
A couple of people in that ilk that I'd love to meet. Sure. I don't think one ever outgrows being starstruck, even if you're in the biz.
Yeah. I tried, as I read The Last Lifeboat this past weekend, I tried to find a part for myself, but the best I could come up with was the stuffed rabbit. So I just couldn't come up with much.
Oh, I can see a lot of roles that you could do.
All right. Well, we're going to move on to that casting. What should folks know about what's coming up for you, sir?
Gosh, so many things, but probably most exciting would be the Actors Fund Tony Awards benefit, which is June 7th at the Skirball Center in Beverly Hills. And then Diva Dish, the second helping at the NoHo Arts Center in North Hollywood, which will be the last two weekends of August. And one last thing I want to add about the book, just
Please.
Outside the spotlight, is even though it's been out for a number of years now, is that Michael Musto, the critic who so praised it, God bless him, when it first came out, he recently did a list of the 10 best celebrity memoirs of all time. And not only was it on the list, but he called it one of the best showbiz books ever written.
Wow.
So I was just blown away and thrilled and so honored by
wow.
that.
Well, again, listeners, we're here with Luke Yankee. Everybody needs to stroll on over to lukeyankee.com. You can learn all about the fun things happening with Luke. We had such an overwhelming response when you were on the show the first time, not just from your brother, but from all of these different folks across the country. And I know folks were picking up copies of your book. And look, is it your story? Absolutely. Is it a link to the past in this just beautiful way? Yes. But you make it all so accessible. And it's such an honor to be a part of that through your words, through your eyes. And just so appreciative, Luke, of everything that you're doing.
Well, and I'm so appreciative of you and that you're getting the word out there. And boy, 303 programs.
I know.
That's very impressive. And just you do such impeccable homework. And I'm just honored to be on a show like this with someone like you, Ken. It's really, it means the world to me.
Well, let's not let another 2 years go by before you come back, sir.
Sounds great.
Times have changed, and we've often rewound the clock since the Puritans got a shock when they landed on Plymouth Rock. If today any shock they should try to stem instead of landing on Plymouth Rock, Plymouth Rock would land on them.
All right, folks, and we are back. So I love when people do creative things to raise money, and I love it even more when there's an amazing cause, and I love it even more than that when it somehow involves superheroes, and I love it all exponentially more than all of the above if these efforts involve former students of mine. I bring to you all Eric Glover, who's going to tell us about the coolest thing ever. Eric, welcome to the show, It's So Gay.
Thank you so much for having me, Ken. You're wonderful.
So we should be very upfront. It's almost like we knew each other in a past life.
Yeah, pretty much. Sarah Lawrence is where I met you and had nothing but good things to say about you ever since. I'm really glad that you're a person who's on Facebook and exists there as a positive person who just drums up change wherever you seem to go. It was really easy tracking you down because a bunch of Sarah Lawrence friends of mine just were tuned into what you were doing. That's how I found you in the first place. So
look at that.
Thank you for being wonderful enough to follow from all my friends and me.
I was a 25-year-old assistant dean there at Sarah Lawrence. I would like to say that I knew what I was doing, Eric, and so that's what I'm going to put out there to the world. You were a student majoring in, not that you had majors in Sarah Lawrence, but what did you study there?
I was there for fiction writing, although I went on to discover screenwriting as my real passion.
I love it. I love it. Well, speaking of films and screenwriting, what crazy idea have you come up with, my friend?
The fundraiser that I'm putting on with my boyfriend is called Give a Sit, the Marvel Movie Marathon. And the idea is to treat it like a cancer walk or an AIDS run, but instead of having people donate for a per mile type thing, we're asking people to donate per movie or per hour as we watch the entirety of the Marvel movies leading up to Age of Ultron coming up this May.
Wow. Now, are you a superhero fanatic?
You know, I really, really am. I fell in love with Superman early on, and it kind of became a snowball effect from there. I've gone on to love everything about DC Comics and Marvel, and a 28-year-old man who watches cartoons featuring those characters on a regular basis. So, yes is the answer to that question.
You know what? I heard a tone in your voice, and as a 38-year-old man who watches those cartoons, I'm not really feeling great about myself right now.
I didn't know we had that in common. Do you like superheroes as well?
I am superhero obsessed. I have recently and finally fallen into Arrow and Flash. Holy cow.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. I'm falling hard in love with those shows too. I've seen everything so far. Are you caught up?
I am about 3 weeks away from being caught up. I will say that there is nothing about Arrow that makes me feel good about my body, but I enjoy watching it.
Those are extremely beautiful specimens on
yeah.
the show.
Yeah, it's a lot. Yeah. It's a lot. Okay, so when you found out, take me back. At one point in time, you're dating this guy. He's attractive. He's sweet. Seems like a great guy. But then it somehow comes up that he has not seen any of these superhero movies. On a very basic level, I would have to imagine that you questioned, how long is this going to last?
Yeah, you know what? He is the opposite of me in a lot of ways when it comes to pop culture. He loves a good story, but almost never in the form of movies. He's a theater guy who loves the stage, loves the live experience, and that doesn't leave a lot of room for superhero blockbusters in his life. So, yeah, finding something to talk about with him when it came to pop culture. There's always been a kind of gap that we've had to overcome, but he's been such incredibly good sport about listening to me gush about people in capes and tights and how seriously I take those stories. And he was on board as soon as I said that the Marvel Movie Marathon was something that we could do in general, even without the fundraising involved. He was ready to do it for me. And I think the fundraising was a really nice cherry on top.
Now, let's talk one word emotions. You have 23 hours coming up of watching a Marvel movie marathon. Let's do contrast and compare. One emotion that you, Eric Glover, are feeling.
Ooh, dread, actually.
Wow.
Dread because Rob, my boyfriend, hasn't been exposed to many of these movies, and not all of them are amazing. So putting him through this whole thing, as sweet as it is on his part, I have to kind of prove to him that these are worth his time. And it's a lot of movie to stuff down his gullet. So I'm feeling a little nervous about it.
Okay. And I would like to remind our listeners, if you are a relationship counselor in the New York City area, I think I have a night for you to sit through because there might be two guys who need some help, just putting that out there. What emotion is he feeling?
Excitement.
Nice.
He is, he's more than a good sport, actually. He's seen glimpses of the things that I watch, and he knows why they excite me, and he's just kind of let that become contagious. He's ready. He's pumped, and he knows it'll be doing some good on top of it. So
okay.
He's in a good space.
He's in a good space. We love that. All right, so we're going to provide the link to everybody. This is one of those youcaring.com sites, and it's an opportunity to raise money for an unbelievable beneficiary. Tell everybody about the beneficiary.
Sure. It's called Capes for Heroes. It's a nonprofit that makes superhero capes for children with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities, or children who are just going through a particularly rough time. Kids often end up on waiting lists, that there's such a high demand for these capes that sometimes kids don't get them as soon as the nonprofit would normally otherwise be available to make them. But that waiting list is something that we've had a goal to clear kids off of with raising enough money. And it just seems to be almost as important as medicine from time to time to have a kid dress up as a superhero, feel brave, feel powerful, feel empowered. These capes seem to be having that effect on them from what I've researched so far and from the talks I've had with the woman who's running the nonprofit, Barbara Casados. It's an amazing cause. I can't think of much better to do with my time if I'm going to be sitting for 23 hours with my boyfriend. And I'm really, really proud to be giving to Capes for Heroes through it.
Wow. I want to go back for a second and reiterate everything you just said. There's a beneficiary that makes capes, superhero capes for kids. I can't get past that, Eric.
Yeah. No, me neither. I've seen videos about what Capes for Heroes has done. I've talked directly, again, with Barbara Casadas, the founder of the group. I've seen some of the effect that it's had, not only just the kids, but people in the local community. The nonprofit is based out of in California. And the ripple effects are nothing but positive. They're tear-jerkingly positive. The people who have contributed to making kids feel good go beyond Barbara. Kids who are not sick make capes. Adults gather to make capes. I am really impressed by just how much of a positive impact it's had for the village it takes to make a change, not just the recipients of that change.
Now, if Eric Glover were to don a cape right now, what would it look like?
It would probably be blue and red. Superman and Spider-Man are two of my favorite characters just ever, even beyond comic books, just in fiction. And they represent a lot of just how good we can be. I think that's why I aspire to be like them. Blue and red are the colors that represent those things to me. And those heroes have been in my life for a really long time. I would proudly don a cape like that.
Nice.
Because of it.
Nice. And I want to remind our listeners that if you are a therapist and you want to talk to Eric about the connection between superheroes and secret identities and gay people, you can find him on Facebook and he will talk about that with you.
Absolutely.
100%. I love it. I'm so excited. I'm so excited for this. And people can join you guys? Can they? I mean, they can't just show up. That you kind of want to know who they are first.
It's a good question, actually. We are open to strangers coming. We've had people who have expressed interest in sitting on our couch with us. But we think it's probably more realistic that people who want to join us are not necessarily going to be in the New York City area. So we do encourage them to follow us along on Facebook. And with our live stream, the 2 days of the marathon on April 25th and 26th, if they want to watch us watch movies, that would be hilarious and fine. And also, if they just want to keep up with us via social media, tweets included along with Facebook, they can time watching movies with us if they like from their own couch and get their own sponsors. And we highly encourage that, actually. We put people's bios and pictures on our page and show that they're a part of this movement too, if they'd like to be.
I love it. I love it. Well, again, folks, the name of the fundraiser, it's called Give a Sit, the Marvel Movie Marathon. They are trying to raise $10,000. We're going to help them out with that. We will be giving you guys on behalf of the show a donation right after we air this interview. The beneficiary is Capes for Heroes. If you didn't hear it the first two times, there's an organization that makes capes for kids, superhero capes, and that is just the most brilliant thing ever. Eric, tell Rob he's going to make it. It's going to be fine. Everybody's going to win.
Thank you so much, Ken. Your kindness knows no bounds. I really appreciate it.
Well, even though we've already had a jam-packed show, we still do have a few minutes left so we can cover some of the LGBT news that's out there in the world. Well, the big news of the week is, of course, Hillary Clinton announcing her bid to become president of these United States. She did so in an announcement video. If you've not seen the announcement video, you should go watch it. And also, there was a little bit of history there as same-sex couple Nathan Johnson and Jared Milrad were featured in Hillary Clinton's video announcing her 2016 presidential run last week. They became the first gay couple to appear in a major candidate's presidential campaign announcement video. If you've not seen it, the video shows Johnson and Milrad discussing their decision to marry. Quote, "It was particularly moving to see Secretary Clinton feature a gay couple engaged to be legally married, the first of any major presidential candidate." That was Jared Milrad from that video saying that. He went on to say, quote, "To us, this decision demonstrates Secretary Clinton's commitment to LGBT equality and the type of inclusive leader she would be as president." There was so much stupid flack. I'm calling it stupid flack. That's where I'm at right now in recording the end of this show, of people saying, well, were those actors, and oh, was that a stunt, and oh, was that tokenizing? Who freaking cares? As opposed to Ted Cruz announcing his bid to become president in an auditorium full of college kids who were told, this is according to some, who were told that they would be in trouble if they did not attend Ted Cruz's announcement to become president of the United States. This was Hillary Clinton making a video and featuring such a diverse swath of American citizenry. I don't care if they were actors, which they weren't. They were actually a couple. I honestly don't even care if it was tokenizing, that she's giving a nod to the LGBT community in a way that the Republican candidates who have already declared are totally against marriage equality and, gosh, totally against LGBT people. I'm fine with this. And all this flack about her logo, who cares? Let's focus on the fact that for the LGBT and ally community right this second, based on who has declared their bid to become president of these United States, Secretary Clinton is by far the greatest choice for equality, for equality. She's even come out and said that the Supreme Court needs to decide for marriage equality. I mean, she's really putting herself out there in a very short amount of time as being for the LGBT community. And her husband, you know, really was the first president to court the LGBT community. So it's nice to see that she is taking that to an even greater level. So many other pieces of news out there that I want to tell you about. We have to touch back on, because it's been a few weeks, all of these religious freedom legislations. A poll released late last week found the majority of Americans believe that businesses should not be allowed to refuse services based on their religious beliefs. The poll conducted by Reuters and Ipsos in the aftermath of controversies around religious freedom legislation in Indiana and Arkansas found that more than 50% disapprove of policies allowing businesses to deny services or refuse to hire people based on the employer's religious beliefs. This should not be surprising to people. Right now in this country, a majority of Americans polled are for marriage equality. Would we not think that a majority of Americans would be against businesses refusing to hire people or denying services based on people's sexual orientation? I mean, there's no way we're going to be for that. So this is an anti-business law. I know, it, again, people are considering it to be pro-religion, but it's also anti-business, and that can't be good in our economy right now. Just putting that out there. Exciting news out of Maryland. Maryland lawmakers late last week passed legislation that would allow transgender residents to change the name and gender listed on their birth certificates without undergoing gender reassignment surgery. Carrie Evans, who's the executive director of Equality Maryland, said this, quote, "This is a big step in recognizing the realities of trans lives and updating our laws to reflect those realities." Very exciting. Both bills passed their respective chambers by veto-proof margins, rendering moot the question of whether they would earn the backing of Governor Larry Hogan. Doesn't matter, because they have passed. Very exciting. We like stories like that. Even more pro-transgender laws and policies being passed. Georgia prison officials enacted a new transgender inmate policies last week, soon after the Department of Justice filed a court brief stating that prison officials must give equal treatment to an inmate's gender identity condition as they would give another medical or mental health condition. The new policy provides transgender inmates with proper health assessments and treatment as necessary. Now, you might be thinking, okay, really? In the Georgia prison system? Yeah, in the Georgia prison system. In all facets of society, we need work to support our trans brothers and sisters. So kudos to the Georgia prison system for making these changes. Good news, good news. By the way, I'm just going to touch on a ton of stories and really briefly, because we haven't done the news in a while and I don't have a lot of time left on this week's episode. Very exciting news out of Washington State. We have featured Washington State on our show previously in our series, These 50 States Are So Gay, in which I think we've only gotten through 4 states in 3 years. But, you know, we'll get to the others at some point. The Washington State House of Representatives last week approved an amended bill to ban conversion therapy. I'm not getting excited for conversion therapy. I'm getting excited for the ban on conversion therapy. This would be an amended bill to ban conversion therapy for LGBT youth. All House Democrats and some Republicans voted in favor of this. The revised bill, which passed 60-37, returns to the Senate for consideration. And of course, the Senate is the home of our good buddy Marco Lias, so we're going to have to reach out to Marco to see what's going on with this bill. We certainly hope that passes. In the House of Representatives in, you know, our entire United States, Democrats in the House of Representatives this week introduced a resolution urging protections against LGBT discrimination. Representative Steve Israel, who is chairman of the House Democratic Policy and Communications Committee, said this, quote, "When intolerance occurs anywhere, everyone has an obligation to take a stand, and Congress doesn't get a waiver on that." So lawmakers are expected to introduce a comprehensive civil rights bill this spring. Very exciting. Very exciting. Out of our military, this is a big story. Again, more on supporting our trans brothers and sisters. Sergeant Shane Ortega, an Army helicopter crew chief, just became the first active service member considered to be openly transgender after the Washington Post published a profile of him last week. Ortega, who identifies as male, is still listed as female in the military's official computer system. He said this, quote, "As I fight for my country in foreign lands, all I want is to be able to serve openly while keeping the job that I love." Ortega said he hopes that serving visibly will force the Pentagon to revisit its ban on openly transgender service members. We certainly hope so. Down in Louisiana, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, a potential Republican presidential candidate, he hasn't announced his bid yet, but people are saying that he probably will, says he is making it a priority to pass his state's version of a religious freedom bill that would allow anti-gay discrimination. And it's a harsher law. Get this, Louisiana, Bobby Jindal, proposing a harsher law than those that sparked controversy in Indiana and Arkansas. He said this, quote, "I know there has been legislation filed this session that aims to protect religious liberty rights in Louisiana. Let me be crystal clear, I absolutely intend to fight for the passage of this legislation and any other that seeks to preserve our most fundamental freedoms." Filed as House Bill 707, the Marriage and Conscience Act. I kid you not, folks, the Marriage and Conscience Act. It was authored by Representative Mike Johnson. It would prevent the state from penalizing a business owner or other individual for expressing a religious belief or moral conviction about marriage. That would mean, for example, that a wedding-related business couldn't be fined for refusing to serve a same-sex couple. It's broader than the since-altered Indiana and Arkansas laws because it involves not just religious, but also, quote, moral beliefs. Man, oh man, oh man. We will end with a heartwarming story, a heartwarming update to the story of a lesbian high school student in Monroe, Louisiana, in the same state where they might pass this Moral and Conscience Act. This was a student whose principal told her she couldn't wear a tuxedo to the prom. Not only has the school backed down, allowing Claudetia Love to dress as she likes, but several companies, love this, have stepped up to donate her outfit. Love that. She will now attend her prom decked out in Nick Casey shoes and a tuxedo from Sharp Suiting. That's thanks to some behind-the-scenes organizing by supportive fashion industry leaders, including Casey Brown, who helped launch gender-neutral clothing company called Grayscale Goods. I love it. Love's custom-made suit will be hand-delivered to the teenager by Brown and Sharp CEO Leon Wu in person prior to the prom, which is scheduled for April 24th. Lest you think that they're not good people doing amazing things out there, they're amazing people doing good things out there. I just urge you to join them, to use your voice. See, these are people donating shoes and a tuxedo for a prom. There are other people just being out about their lives. There are other people starting conversation. You got to figure out what it is that you do to use your voice in an amazing way. We had Luke Yankee on the show earlier. He's writing, he's directing, he's hosting parties. He's telling stories about old school Hollywood. Love Luke Yankee, thanks to him. And of course to Eric Glover, who has organized an event where they're just going to be sitting for 23 hours watching movies and raising money to buy superhero capes for kids. These are folks using their voice. I urge you to use yours. Get out there. Go make a difference for your LGBT ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there making a difference, while you're out there using your voice, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?